This is Bloomberg Intelligence.
We're really getting into now the streaming arms race.
Dish is looking at that and saying we can really build a nice niche for ourselves.
In-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
The dollar is the dominant currency in the planet.
I think the acquisition is a natural progression of what Microsoft can do with this technology going forward.
Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Over the next hour, we're going to dig inside the big business stories impacting Wall Street and the global markets.
Each and every week, we provide in-depth research and data on some of the 2,000 companies and 130 industries that our analysts cover worldwide.
Coming up on the show, oil producers hold the line on capital spending budgets and focus on their debt.
Plus, footwear maker Allbirds has plenty of room to run in the athleisure space.
But first, let's talk about cars. We got Mercedes, BMW, Volkswagen are potentially looking at a weak third quarter. For more, I want to bring in Michael Dean, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior European Autos Analyst. Is this purely a chip story now for the third quarter?
I think so. So it looks like the Germans have been hit particularly hard. And Mercedes in particular, they could lose about 20% of their production in the third quarter due to chip shortages.
This chip shortage, I know it's a global thing affecting many, many different industries, but if I'm an auto manufacturer, I have to consider myself one of the biggest, if not the best customers of every chip company out there, maybe aside Apple. What are the automakers saying about the chip industry? How upset are they with this, you know, going to be nearly a year issue?
Yeah, if you take a step back, if we look this time last year at the height of lockdowns, the auto companies cut back their production schedules quite severely and therefore cut their orders for chips. And in the meantime, consumer electronics demand was going crazy. They took up the slack, and then we had quite a strong recovery in the second half of last year. And the automakers really struggled to get that chip supply back on. And then we've had natural disasters this year. And then the latest disaster has been the shutdown in Malaysia of factories due to COVID-19. And Malaysia is a big hub for testing and packaging of microchips. So that's really caused the shortage for this quarter.
There is a school of thought out there that you're going to have the Delta variant way on demand. We've heard peak growth conversations in Europe, UK, US. And that by the time that Delta's kind of out of the picture, we'll magically have all these chip factories and all the supply chain issues will be solved. For the automakers, is there any truth in that narrative?
That would be a dream scenario. The issue that's happening at the moment, this came out from the motor show in Munich, is that now they see supply constraints going into 2022. So the knock-on effect of this is that, firstly, numbers are probably too high for 2021, but they could be too high for 2022. And if this supply constraint continues, then the automakers have to think of something different about, you know, supplying the chips in the future.
So, Michael, you mentioned, were you in Munich for this auto show?
Yes, I was. There wasn't a stick shifter in sight or an electric vehicle at all.
I know. So, all right, so we had... So Bloomberg had you and Matt Miller in Munich. This is the first time that we've had
a
car show where it's actually people have been there for quite some time. Give us a sense of what it was like to be back and seeing some of the companies and what the companies were doing, the salespeople, and kind of just give us a sense of what the show was like.
Yeah, it was so nice. It was nice to see company management. It was nice to see clients. It was nice to see the product. And, you know, this is the auto industry. It's all about the product. And there's a really good buzz around the city. It was all focused on battery electric vehicles, and it's really seeing what the Germans now have to offer in competition to Tesla. So Audi had a great stand. I got to test drive the GT e-tron,
which
was a fantastic car. We saw the Audi Q4, which is going to be a key competitor to the Model 3. Porsche had a great stand, and it's probably going to have the highest share of battery electric vehicles of any legacy automaker by 2025. And Mercedes had some great products along with BMW. So it was a really fantastic event.
I've been reading, too, that some of the luxury car makers, well, everyone kind of jacked up their price when they were dealing with the supply shortages and they were putting the chips into the high-end cars because that's where their margins are going to be. But I've also read some articles that these kind of sexy cars are going to, they're going to keep the prices high even once the chip problem levels itself out and then keep really juicy margins. Is that true?
Yeah, it's interesting. So, you know, Mercedes is going to take a real hit in the third quarter. They lose about 20% of their production. But for the first half, there was a supply constraint, but it wasn't significant. So automakers were focusing on their high-margin cars. There was a lack of inventory at dealers, which was good for pricing. So if they do keep back a certain amount of vehicles and it becomes sort of demand-driven the sales for automakers, then they can continue to charge good prices, and that's only good for margins going forward.
So, Michael, let's talk about the battery electric vehicle market. I mean, it's we've really seen over the last year and a half the big automakers, like you mentioned, some of the big German ones and European players, but as well as Ford and General Motors and so on. They've really upped their ante in the electric vehicle market. What you learned in Munich, how confident are the German automakers or the European automakers that they can really drive that market forward?
Yeah, it's a good question, because as I said, there were only really battery electric vehicles on sale, and that made up 3% of the German automaker sales in the first half. So they've still got a long way to go, and so it's still reliant on government subsidies. Pricing is going to be very important, particularly batteries, so they're reliant on battery prices coming down. Infrastructure needs to improve, so we need more charging points. So all these factors are going to play into whether consumers take on, you know, battery electric vehicles, as the companies have told us they will in capital markets days this year.
Who's the best positioned? Who do you like the best?
Well, Volkswagen has given the sort of most credible plan, and because through its various brands, it has a significant amount of new models coming out over the next 6 to 12 months. So they're in a very good position to sort of overtake Tesla by, I think, 2022 and 2023 in terms of actual volumes of BEVs. Mercedes also very much focused on their electric vehicles. They've got six new vehicles coming up, which are battery electric vehicles, which they showcased in Munich. So I think those two brands or companies in particular can sort of give Tesla a run for its money.
All right, Michael, thanks a lot. Michael Dean, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior European Autos Analyst, joining us there.
Coming up on the program, real-time driving and dining data show Europe is primed to lead the global stocks. More next.
You are listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 13 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, let's take a look at this stock market. All-time highs for indices pretty much across the board, seemingly on a daily basis. But people are trying to get a sense of where we are with the Delta variant and how that's going to impact consumer demand, the economy, and overall stock market appreciation. Let's break it down with Bloomberg Chief Equity Strategist Gina Martin Adams. So, Gina, when you take a look at some of the real-time signals, I know you guys look at that, whether it's dining or driving. That's really good data for you guys to think about where the economy is going. What are you seeing right now?
So what we're seeing is actually a little bit of activity that favors Europe over other areas of the world. We look at things like, you know, the amount of diners at restaurants. We look at driving direction requests both to offices as well as in generic terms. And then we also look at the PMIs, like the manufacturing and the services PMIs. And the sum total of all of it is generally Europe appears to be picking up a degree of activity here in the late summer months relative to the rest of the world. One intriguing statistic that came out of our work is that U.S. diners over the last 3 months were actually lower than they were in the same three-month period last summer, which I thought was quite intriguing, as U.S. activity is basically flat from a dining perspective, and rest of the world is picking up at a double-digit pace.
Well, that really pairs with what a lot of strategists are saying when they keep kind of warning of a correction in the equity market. They all kind of reluctantly in some way recommend like Europe and Japan to some extent.
Yeah, and I think that certainly has been what our models would suggest as well, really starting in the summer months, saying that the U.S. is looking a little bit rich and is also likely to face tougher comps as we go forward. And the rest of the world is lagging a little bit in terms of reopening or reemergence of economies, if you will. And that generally favors other areas of the world over U.S. stocks. I think that, you know, these are just a few small statistics in the grand scheme of things, but in a general sense, U.S. stocks have definitely enjoyed some degree of defensiveness as well as early mover status, with the economic rebound being extremely powerful in the U.S. That certainly has gotten priced in the U.S. market, leaving opportunities in the global stock market somewhat concentrated outside of U.S. stocks.
So, Gene, if you think about the U.S. market, I mean, I've seen some folks on the street say, hey, we think Delta's peaked. It's actually starting to turn down in terms of the second derivative. This might be another move up in kind of the reopening trade, the cyclical trade. How do you think about that?
it does appear in the statistics, first of all, that Delta looks like it has peaked. I think that the trick right now is in each former case in which Delta was peaking, we had easy comparisons going forward. I mean, if you think about just the sequencing and the timing of events, that's the real trick this fall is the U.S. was already in a relatively rapid recovery come fall of last year, and that's reflected in the earnings growth rates, which really picked up pretty precipitously into end of year last year and starting earlier this year. So kind of the easy comparisons that companies enjoyed over the last year start to go away. So even though Delta may have peaked, the same is the case for the economic data, which really started picking up in great pace in the summer of 2020 into the fall of 2020. It makes the case that, you know, it's just a really difficult environment to surpass those levels on a year-ago basis, and certainly surpassing 2021 peak levels is going to be incredibly difficult for the U.S. economy as well as the U.S. stock market at large.
Something that we're also sort of contending with, which is different than a year ago, is inflation. Yes, the CPI this week was still strong. It didn't come in as hot as we thought, but producer prices are quite high. That leads to margin squeeze questions. What usually performs well during inflationary times, and is that playbook like working right now?
So it varies depending upon the generation of inflation. Right. I think that over the last decade, we got accustomed. Yeah, exactly. Okay. A little bit of a tongue twister there. But over the last decade, we got accustomed to this notion that every inflation was a good inflation. Every inflation was driven by demand recovery. And therefore, you had cyclicals outperform. You had small caps outperform because it was basically a reflection of recovering economic activity. Now we're seeing something a little bit different because what we're seeing is economic activity, in particular in the U.S., looks to be slowing a touch, nothing necessarily nefarious, but slowing a touch while inflation pressures remain high. So that would suggest that to some extent this inflation that we're experiencing is not necessarily purely driven by a recovery in demand, but also, as we all have talked about for a lot of the last year, driven by some supply constraints and dynamics on the supply side. That creates a lot more complication for the inflation landscape than we've experienced in quite some time. What it generally should mean, in our view, is that consumer-focused industries probably struggle a bit because they pay a lot more for higher input costs. They're experiencing a bit of wage pressures. At the same time, you see a bit of a slowdown in demand. That puts the pressure on consumer-focused industries, while the producer industries can generally pass on price increases. So I do think it will be variant across industries and sectors in the S&P 500. Certainly not typical, as was the case, over the last 10 years. The typical inflation landscape of the last 10 years really doesn't necessarily apply to what to expect over the next year or so.
All right, Gina. So given that inflation background, does it kind of play into where Fed Chairman Jay Powell wants to take this economy, which is we're going to begin to taper at some point, but we're going to do it in a measured way based upon kind of where the numbers are? Does he have some more ammunition there?
Yeah, I think he does. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that the Fed is still operating a really intensive crisis era policy when the crisis is slowly going away. We had the largest infusion of Fed support that we've ever seen in the market in 2020. The recession ended more than a year ago. So he has plenty of case to be made to slowly take that punch bowl away, so to speak, and really shift policy. But he has time to do it as well. I mean, I don't think that the inflation pressures are so profound as to expect that there's an embedded degree of inflation yet. Mm-hmm. And most people would suggest that some of the supply constraints, at least, will start to ease over the course of the next couple of quarters. But we probably do need to start removing that punch bowl. And I think that the Fed is acknowledging that. And they're saying, look, we no longer need to operate this crisis policy, but we can take our time.
Before we let you go, small caps?
Yeah, small caps are one of these interesting groups, very similar to what I was suggesting with the inflation landscape. Mm-hmm. Small caps did great with inflation last cycle. They're not doing so great with inflation this cycle.
It is really interesting.
This is a very different kind of inflationary impulse.
All right, Gina, thank you so much. We really appreciate it, as always. That's Gina Martin Adams, Bloomberg Intelligence Chief Equity Strategist.
All right, coming up on the program, footwear maker footwear maker Allbirds sales could reach $1 billion by 2025. Have you worn them?
I have not.
They're amazing. pricing.
Are they?
I don't have them. My husband does. They are awesome. I'm check that out. More on the next.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BI Go on the terminal. I'm Paul Sweeney.
And I'm Alex Steele. It's 25 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
We'll be here each and every week at this time, tapping into our Bloomberg Intelligence analyst covering some 2,000 companies and 130 industries worldwide.
Okay, so the way I found out about Allbirds is David Westin, Balance of Power, former co-anchor.
Very stylish guy.
Super stylish. He would disagree with that characterization. He got a pair of Allbirds for Christmas and like couldn't stop talking about them for at least an hour 1 year. So then I bought some for my husband, and they are kind of awesome. And they look like they could also raise an awesome amount of money if they IPO. Want to break that all down with Poonam Goyal, Bloomberg Intelligence, a senior U.S. retail analyst. Okay, what kind of sales are we talking about here?
We are talking about them going from $200 billion in sales to $1 billion in 5 years. You know, the shoes are absolutely incredible. You said it, they're comfortable. But really, it's not just that they're comfortable, but that they're also sustainable. And I think that's their edge.
Hmm. All right. Is this all part of this athleisure segment of the market? If so, give us a sense of what that's all about.
Absolutely. The athleisure market, you've heard the names Lululemon, Nike, Adidas, all of them on fire, a $300 billion global market. Allbirds just taking a little over $200 million of that. So lots of runway to grow in a growing market that's growing by double digits almost every year, and the pandemic has only fueled it further.
When you say that they're sustainable, what does that mean?
That means that they are making their shoes with all sustainable recycled material.
Is there like ground up plastic bottles?
Plastic bottles, everything. So cardboard, plastic bottles, anything that's recyclable and reusable, they're using it to make their shoes. Obviously, there's technology added to that to give it the performance and the fit that you need in a pair of running shoes or even casual shoes. But wood, you name it, it's all made from nature, and that's how they make their shoes.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now on the website. Recycled bottles, castor bean oil, recycled cardboard, sheep. I mean, not the actual sheep, but like the fur.
So Poonam, as we think about this business, is this something that Nike could just turn around and do and squash these guys just by doing something similar?
Well, everyone is trying to do something similar. So, you know, Nike is a $40+ billion brand. And they do have some lines of shoes that are sustainable and also comfortable. But at the end of the day, Nike is a brand that's focused on core performance. Hmm. So for them to give that up to go after a category that Allbirds is in, where they have $200 million in sales and even potentially $1 billion in 5 years, that's still a very small segment for them to go after. This is about operating in a niche segment, operating in a segment that the consumer, and especially the younger consumer, wants to be in. So we think Allbirds has the potential to grow in that market and really maintain its share today and then grow it further, because that is what the customer is looking for.
And they're also
will Allbirds be $40 billion? Probably not, but $1 billion is in sight.
And they're also doing clothes now. How new is that?
They're doing clothes as well. That's fairly new. I'd say it's more recent than the last year and a half. And it's a very, very small market. They don't even break out the sales. But that, too, has potential. As consumers become more increasingly aware of the brand, we think that their clothing will also catch on, and that's another outlet for growth for them.
Who's kind of the target market? I'm guessing David Westin's of the world and Paul Sweeney's of the world are
not necessarily the target
market. So give us a sense about the end market.
You'd be surprised, actually. Obviously, the younger customer, right, the millennial, is a target market. But when people are gifted these shoes, whether it's, you know, someone's father, it doesn't necessarily have to be that younger customer, and they try them on. They absolutely love them.
Mm-hmm.
So we really think that the target market is wider than what they're targeting to. And most of these people are realizing what Allbirds is capable of when they actually try on the shoes and use them. I know so many people that have them, and I have not heard one bad thing.
Even my mother, my mother bought the Allbirds for my husband. It was my recommendation. And she's a, you know, super snotty fashionista. And even she was like, oh, these are pretty cute. We've now done like a 10-minute commercial for Allbirds. So where are the problems here?
The problems are really just about scaling, right? How are they going to scale their business? How are they going to get to from a $200 million brand to a $1 billion brand? They have to grow internationally. They have to add more stores. They only have 27 stores. Hmm. So their entire business is online. But as they open stores, they get brand awareness. And we need to see them doing more of that. So I think they'll run into some hurdles there because, you know, operating a store is very different than operating an online business. But the market is attractive, and we think they're going to grow in it and take their fair share plus some more.
Again, this feels like, again, a millennial, a Gen Z type of thing, and those folks are extraordinarily comfortable buying pretty much anything online. So is that going to continue to be, you think, their primary distribution way to get this product out?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. We think 3/4 of the business, even as they expand stores, will still come from digital, but they will grow stores. You know, 27 stores is probably too little. We see them growing to 100 stores, if not more, in the next 5 years.
Poonam, thanks a lot. Poonam Goyal, Bloomberg Intelligence, Senior U.S. Retail Analyst.
All right, coming up on the program, the outlook for European Central Bank credit buying, plus oil producers with $30 billion in free cash flow, might pay a premium to pay down some of their debt.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 39 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Oil prices surprise pretty much everybody at around $70 a barrel, and that means oil companies are raking in the cash. On the list of priorities, in addition to shareholder returns, are going to be paying down debt. So let's dig into that with Spencer Cutter, Bloomberg Intelligence U.S. credit analyst, joins us now. Spencer, when they repay this debt, how much debt is out there? What do they have to pay for it?
Well, that's really it's really sort of a high-class problem that the industry is facing today. Things have been kind of turned on their head from where they were 5 or 6 years ago. Companies today, if you look at sort of the 20 largest oil and gas producers in North America, they're estimated to generate somewhere in the neighborhood of $30 billion a year in free cash flow each of the next couple of years. And their focus, as you've mentioned, has been to pay down debt, and they have been doing that. And also with oil prices and gas prices where they are, natural gas prices, the bond market has been on a tear. So to the extent these companies have bonds that they weren't quite ready to pay down yet, they've refinanced them. So now you really don't have a whole lot of debt coming due in the next 2 or 3 years. There's not much of any credit line debt outstanding. So all the debt that's out there, if they want to pay it down in the next year or two with all this free cash flow, they're going to have to pay a premium for it. Those bonds all have call protection on them, and the longer the maturity, generally speaking, the higher the call protection, so you have to pay a premium. It's either that or just stockpile billions of dollars of cash on your balance sheet and wait for the bond maturities to approach, but you know, that's not very efficient capital structure management over the next couple of years.
Yeah. So, Spencer, boy, with your companies, every time we talk to you, it's either boom or bust. So this sounds it sounds like more of a boom time here. What's the pressure on these companies to just buy back stock and kind of push the creditors to the back of the line?
There is a lot of growing pressure. If you get on any of these earning calls, it's a question that gets asked over and over and over again, every company, and has been getting asked for at least the last year, as prices have recovered from sort of that trough we saw in early 2020. So you're getting a lot of pressure. Companies have started to institute some of these variable dividends, or kind of the new thing within the sector, where they're saying they're going to pay out somewhere like 25 or 50% of the free cash flow that was generated in the prior quarter as a dividend. But that's only a couple of companies so far. Others are saying that they might go down that road in the future. But before they get there, they're still talking about paying down debt. Occidental, you know, they did a $3 billion debt tender last couple months ago, but they still want to reduce debt.
Yeah, but they need to. But some of these guys really need to reduce it. Because, Oxy levered up when it bought in Anadarko.
Yes, so Oxy levered up, absolutely, at the worst possible time. Given
no one liked that.
But, you know, they're talking about, you look at where their leverage is going to come in, you know, this year and next year, assuming oil prices stay where they are, it's still not it's not bad. They've kind of been rescued over the last 12 months with what's happened with commodity prices. But they're talking about reducing debt to what they're saying is a mid-$20 billion level, and they're about $32 billion today. So that's a lot of debt that they're going to have to pay down. And even some of the smaller companies, I think Apache is going to have to pay down somewhere in the neighborhood of $2 billion. Ovintiv, Continental, both have indicated they want to get their total debt levels down to about $3 billion from somewhere in the neighborhood of $5 billion today. So they all are getting a lot of pressure to start boosting dividends, do share buybacks. But before they get there, they've set out these targets and they've said, we want to get leverage down to some sort of sustainable level. We want to hit these debt targets. And once they're there, then I think you start to see a lot of these variable dividends and big share buybacks come into play.
All right, Spencer, I've seen from the energy space in the past when we have oil around $70, I've got some free cash flow in my pocket. I'm kind of tempted to go drill some more rigs. Is that going to happen this time?
So the sector, both on the investor and management side, seems to have gotten religion, so to speak, around focusing on free cash flow instead of growth. And so what all these companies are doing today is they're only spending enough to basically maintain their current production profile. That said, and everybody's saying they're going to keep doing that, but I got to think, it's really hard to pass up, oil around 70, gas at 450 or higher. It's hard to say I'm not going to take an extra couple hundred million or billion dollars and put it into an expanded drilling program that I know is going to generate a ton of free cash flow and maybe put in some hedges in place in order to, back that up. We haven't seen it yet. But, there's two things that govern markets, fear and greed. And greed has got to be sitting out there. People have got to be thinking about it.
But now, if you even said the word hedging, everyone would freak out and hate you for it. Spencer, thanks a lot. Bloomberg Intelligence U.S. credit analyst Spencer Cutter.
All right. Just as the U.S. Federal Reserve is buying back fixed income securities in the U.S., the European Central Bank is doing the same in Europe, and our next guest thinks that they might even pick up their pace. For more, let's welcome Bloomberg Intelligence Chief European Credit Strategist Mahesh Bingalingam. All right, Mahesh, so let's talk about the ECB. Just give us a sense of how active they've been in terms of buying securities this year and kind of how you think that might play out for the remainder of the year.
One thing I want to point out to all listeners is the ECB is a much bigger player in terms of percentage outstanding that they buy compared to the Fed. The Fed buys a much bigger volume, no doubt. But let's say in terms of how much bunds they buy, in terms of how much corporates they buy, in terms of any other government securities that they buy, the ECB is a much, much bigger presence. So talking about credit, for example, monthly overall QE, the ECB has been buying about $100 billion last 4 or 5 months, which they have brought it down to 80, and they said they're going to buy 80. The ECB doesn't want to say that it is a taper. It is a step down, surely. The ECB leads the Fed on this, by the way. And in that, the ECB previously, before the pandemic, was buying, 8-9% credit. Because of the pandemic, it is buying a lot more government bonds, and hence credit share came down. Recently, it has been buying about 6-7%. I expect that share to go up. So, yes, the ECB is a massive presence in credit and government bonds compared to the Fed.
Okay, so if they recalibrate, as what they said, when they're going to recalibrate PEP, which is their emergency purchase program, what will be the effect on the bond market versus, say, when the Fed winds up just rolling off some more mortgage-backed securities and treasuries?
So if they bring it down to 80, even that talk itself has already had an impact on the bund. We've hit the tights of the year, let's say, towards the end of July. And ever since that, due to inflation, as well as this fear of ECB buying less, has brought the bund up. It has gone from, for people in the U.S., they might be shocked that government bonds pay you minus 60 basis points, right? Minus 60 went up to nearly zero. Come back a little bit, but the point is it's had a big impact on the government bond market, part one. In credit, the fact that they're still buying, 5 to 6 billion, even with despite taper, this is August, by the way. Before that, they were buying about 7 to 8 billion gross. August is about 6 billion gross. it hasn't had much of an impact because that number is still very sizable. You need to realize August, the Europeans, unlike the Americans, tend to take a lot of holidays, and supply tends to be very minimal. And despite that, the ECB ended up buying 6 billion gross in August. So in credit, until and unless the 80 comes down to a much smaller number, I think credit will still hold in. Corporate bond portfolio managers are waiting to see when that number becomes something like a 30 or a 40. Then it will have a much bigger impact on credit. But for now, the impact is on rates.
All right. So Mahesh, here in the U.S., we have a Federal Reserve that is, you know, talking about tapering. Yet, if we look at the 10-year Treasury yield, it's still down around 1.3%. Give us a sense of kind of what the market's thinking in Europe about rates over there, because here in the U.S., it just seems lower for longer is kind of here.
If you realize, you know, towards the beginning of the year, the U.S. led the way in terms of whether it is going down in terms of rates or later on in terms of inflation fear. But last 1.5 months, the U.S. has lagged Europe. Particularly the Bund has been the leader in terms of initially blowing up on inflation and later in terms of the central bank buying less than what they would. The ECB has announced that it is going to buy less than what they would. They don't call it taper. Lagarde says that the lady isn't for tapering, you know, bringing out the inner Margaret Thatcher in her. But the fact remains, the ECB has announced it will buy less. The Fed hasn't announced. The Fed is still saying that it is going to look at data, depends on inflation, depends on growth, and so on and so forth. So as a result, U.S. Rates are still very well supported. Inflation still hasn't zoomed up compared to expectations. Everything is related to expectations, right? While in Europe, even though the absolute number is lower, it has been higher. German CPI has printed much higher. All these things have fed into European rates leading on the way higher for the last 1.5 months. But nevertheless, you need to realize the absolute number is still much lower than in America.
All right, Mahesh, thank you so much. We really appreciate it. That's Mahesh Abhimalingam, Bloomberg Intelligence Chief European Credit Strategist. That's this week's edition of Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
And remember, you can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 57 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.